Hello, welcome to the AFPT Comics Podcast, episode 344. I was told once, don't talk about the numbers because no one cares, because chances are someone's listening for the first time, and do they give a crap? I don't know. But my name's David Brook, and I'm here with Chris Copeland. We're here to talk about comics, have special guests on, and recap the week in comics news. How you doing, Chris?
Good. I think the numbers are for us. Like, this is the one part, just for us, the one tiny little part. Everything else is for the people.
Oh, yeah, true, because it's like bragging. Like, look how many.
Yes, look how much I've done. It's look like how much of my
dollar
life
bills.
I've
It's like MTV Cribs. It's like, look at this waterbed that's
this is where all the magic happens.
Exactly. Speaking of magic happens, I was pondering this question earlier today. If the X-Men swapped with Batman, do you think they could clean up Gotham quicker than Batman would?
I feel like Gotham would be worse off.
Oh, interesting.
With all that
X-Men hater,
with all that drama.
Oh, you don't think Jean could just clean it up?
I think they'd be too busy.
Oh, with their
getting
own
into
drama.
Like with their sexy love triangles and
interesting
weird
interesting.
Parental issues.
I feel
it might get worse.
I mean, let me think. Aren't there some metahumans in Gotham? I mean, Killer Croc's not really
there are.
A metahuman, is he? But I know there's like.
The worst kind of metahuman.
I'm just wondering if any of them would want to join the X-Men, or maybe join Magneto, because maybe he shows up too. It's a question.
Like Magneto
that,
would be a better option.
A lot of people are talking about right now. It's all over the news, CNN, NBC.
Not just us.
Last week tonight, his big thing this Sunday is what?
Yeah,
if,
the whole.
What if the X-Men went to Gotham?
Third act is just X-Men. It's crazy.
This whole act of this show isn't all X-Men, although there is some X-Men news this week. Before we get to the news, though, Mike Del Mundo's on the show to talk all about his new art book, The Marvel Art of Mike Del Mundo from Clover Press. This is I wish I knew off the top of my head. I think it's the fourth Marvel Art of book. This one is particularly unique, though, because it comes with an additional sketchbook for a small fee. And I say small because I actually was surprised how cheap the 200-page sketchbook comes with the main book. But we dig into how cool the sketchbook is in the interview, along with some advice for artists from Del Mundo. If you don't know Del Mundo, iconic cover artist starting at Marvel, covers that tend to have really clever design engineering kind of ideas. It's not just Batman punching someone, but sometimes like using a reflection in water to convey something in the story. And we dig into that too. It's a pretty enlightening interview. And if you're familiar with Del Mundo, you know he's one of the most unique cover artists out there.
Yeah, I don't think anybody does kind of what he does in terms of like technical skill and presenting new angles. And the book looks really great. I'm excited to sit down and hear more of the chat with him.
I definitely backed it the day it launched. I know there's only a few more days as of this recording. So go check it out. There's a link on the AIPT Comics podcast post for this. You can go check out the extras, but also the standard bundle and all that. But before we get to the interview, let's recap the biggest news of the week. And once again, I always pluck the biggest news as what's everyone talking about the most. And this week, Dan Mora has a variant cover for DC KO number one, DC's big event coming up in a few weeks. And the variant cover is very interesting because it actually shows us all 32 fighters that are in this bracket style melee fighting event. And whoever wins gets to essentially become Darkseid, which is pretty crazy. But are there any surprises, Chris, that you think shouldn't be in there or should? Or who do you think might win?
I've already picked my winner. Ooh. as the Demon Etrigan. I do like the fact that they included, I feel like they have a really good balance of heroes and villains here, which I think makes a lot of. I am a little concerned about Jay Garrick being in this.
A lot of people were criticizing how many Bat characters there are.
There are a lot of Bat characters.
Robin, Jason Todd. You can see the image on AIPTComics.com, of course. Jaro was another one that a lot of people were plucking out going, what?
That's definitely one that I was like, huh.
I think
he goes all the way to the end, that would be amazing.
I mean, it is Scott Snyder, so it's probably going to be in the top four, I'd bet. Because in his Justice League run, Jaro was a huge character.
Yeah.
I personally think it would be interesting if Swamp Thing won. Similar to Etrigan, a character that's a little underused right now. But think about this. Swamp Thing is, he's got the green, right? The power of almost life itself. What if he got the anti-life power? Now we've got an interesting combo.
He's unstoppable. Mm-hmm. He's still made of plant, but he's unstoppable.
Okay, speaking of unstoppable, a lot of people posting GIFs on our tweet about this, of Zatanna destroying Jason Todd in like a snap. Now, yes, the power levels are kind of wacky, but consider this. They're probably all on like a similar scale, like depowered or something. We don't know
yet. I would hope everybody's depowered and it's just fist fights and maybe a knife or two or a sword.
But yeah, it is fun to look at this. And if you go back and listen to the last Scott Sutter interview on this podcast, he says there's never been a event like this at DC, a whole just fighter versus kind of comic thing. Usually there's some other bigger story involved.
They did some like version of that in a Robin run from in the last couple of years, I believe, where he was like on that island fighting.
Oh yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Damian so was.
I think that was a pretty cool idea. So yeah, the fact that they're like extrapolating that for the entire line is interesting. I'm still not entirely sold on it, but the more I see from it, I'm like, okay, all right, well, at least we're doing a kind of new event.
It's big, it's fun. It's also not horror. There's been a couple horror events lately at DC, so
yeah,
should be fun. Speaking of fun, Hulk is going to smash everything. That's never
everything.
Before. Has that ever happened?
I've never seen that.
It's a series called Hulk Smash Everything. It's a 5-issue miniseries by Ryan North and Vincenzo Caratu. Adam Kubert did the cover for this. Again, a lot of people talking about it because it's like, this doesn't seem new. But then Ryan North has gone on record saying, hey, you know, you think you run out of things to smash, but you don't when you really put your mind to it.
Is he going to, like, smash a planet? Is he going to smash the concept of time?
Ooh, interesting.
Smash people's inability to love, like smash that apart.
Okay, you're going outside of the physical. Interesting.
Yeah, we're getting abstract. We're getting weird. I mean, that's where I would go.
Hulk versus horoscopes. Look at that. It writes itself.
Hulk versus human disdain.
Indeed. Also from Marvel, the Maker's Return coming in December, but also Ultimate Daredevil? I did a question mark on that one, so it was a little spicy.
It's a huge question mark.
But here's the crazy thing. It's not just, oh, Matt Murdock, oh, lawyer. No, cosmic. Eh? Crazy. We have got some cover art by Ryan Segman on the website as well, and it features the Guardians of the Galaxy, which appeared in the Ultimates, I think it was issue 6. I'm guessing Daredevil will be somehow tied to these cosmic, futuristic characters, literally from like the year 3000.
I feel like the phrase Ultimate Daredevil this week made people go a little crazy. So I think that's a thing that people have been waiting for, which is great. I love it. And the fact that it is, that cosmic tinge is huge. But I feel like I saw a lot of people freaking out about Ultimate Daredevil. And it is still very much big question mark.
Alex Pacnadel is co-writing with Dennis Camp. And he says, he's still the fearless hero at his core, but now redefined on a cosmic scale. Which reminded me, War of the Realms, that event that happened, I think, 6 years ago. Do you remember when Daredevil got the sight from Heimdall?
Yes.
And he became like a god.
Yeah, effectively.
It was a, or like a demigod. I remember people really hyped for that too, because, you know, as a street-level hero, it's like, ooh, what can we do with this?
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder, like, if Daredevil was cosmic, what would he even eat? And then I thought, wait a minute. Meals to Astonish #1 from Marvel also was announced this week.
You've done some really good transitions on this show, but that is...
Those are the best. Those are the best. The cringiest, the better.
Yeah.
Cringy, the better.
Because I don't know where you're going, and then boom, pivot.
So Marvel put together they're putting together a one-shot that's collecting the Infinity comic, Test Kitchen. Steve Orlando's behind this one, among other creators, but there's a funny cover where all the characters are eating wildly different foods. I don't know what restaurant they're at, but it's...
Yeah, well, this is the greatest or worst restaurant. This is like Cheesecake Factory level of just There's steamed buns, there's corn dogs.
Hamburger, like, there's actually a couple hamburgers, I think. Why? And then Venom is, he's not eating with his hands, he's licking something.
Oh, he's yeah.
His tongue is picking up like a chili dog or something.
It looks like some kind of chop. I don't, you know what? Good for him, though. If that's how you want to eat.
Miss Marvel drinking a Mai Tai? I think she's underage for that. I don't know.
She might, yeah. Unless it's a virgin cocktail.
Could be. I don't know. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe that's the big cliffhanger.
Lots of boba, though. Lots of boba.
I hate boba.
Ugh. It's...
It is. You know, let's turn this into the Boba podcast. Boo Boba. That's the name of the show. Guys, we're drinking a new boba, and we're here at Universal Studios drinking the Harry Potter boba, and no. In our last bit of Marvel news, some new covers for X-Men, from the Age of Revelation X-Men books, which are coming out and starting this October, where the new X-Men titles will be changed completely as they jump ahead 10 years. And once again, we've got Cyclops with the beard. People are really hot for the Cyclops beard look. Makes me wonder if it's your time to shine, my friend.
I'm honestly in love with what they've done with Glob Herman. Badass Glob Herman is about time. But yes, bearded Cyclops is acceptable.
You know, now that I'm looking at it, Wolverine, very hairy. Wendigo here, very hairy. Very, a lot of hair in this event.
Everybody's got hair.
God, you know what? There could have been a great cross promotional thing with Nair.
Mm.
And Nair was the solution at the end of the event.
Wow. Your storytelling skills are
why I'm are not untouched, an editor
unmatched.
of Spider-Man or X-Men, I don't know.
I think it's the restraining orders they have.
That could be. I'm not allowed in New York State.
Right.
For five reasons. Moving on one to some of those is comics X-Men. News. Corin Howell's Lilith will return. AIPT had the official announcement earlier this week. It's launching in 2026. It was also, the first series was also part of Vault Comics' adult line of comics. Did you mess with Lilith at all?
I read the first couple of issues. I kind of liked it. I think Vault did a really good job of kind of introducing that adult energy, the adult kind of themes really well. I'm excited to see it, you know, come back, but yeah, I don't think I gave it enough of a chance to really like let it sit with me, but I think they were on to something. So I think coming back that, you know, shows a commitment to these kinds of comics, which is great.
It's a pretty good hook. It's an immortal character that was banished from hell and living undercover on Earth as a model while secretly feeding on humans, which is pretty much every model's lifestyle.
Which, yeah, exactly how all models have existed since the 80s.
You gotta love the jokes that just write themselves. Moving on to our last bit of news. Oh boy, howdy. Comics is going to Hollywood. If you are aware of the show Dracula Titans Season 2 was announced this week, and Todd McFarlane and Steve Orlando will be judges on the show. It's a horror drag show, which I've really loved the last couple years. Actually, I am going to go see them in 2 days on Tuesday in Boston, live.
Wow. That'll be fun.
And it looks like we might be able to get them on the show, too, for an interview. They were on the show with Steve Orlando, actually. Back in 2021, we were talking because the Boulay brothers took over Heavy Metal Magazine for a month. Steve wrote and curated a bunch of stories with their characters, the Boulay's characters, being in at least one of the stories, if I'm not mistaken. And since then, they've written two tales, one in DC Horror Presents and another in Hello Darkness. So they continue to go into comics, and it's cool to see them bringing comics creators into their show.
Yes, I like that. I don't know the crossover kind of with, you know, the brothers' audience with comics, but it seems like it's enough of a circle, so I think it's cool. And again, anything that kind of elevates the weirder, horror-adjacent, creepy, nerdy side of comics into a different audience is always great.
Yeah, every season there is at least one episode where they bring up comics, like they need to make a horror superhero, and their drag is that. Last season, for instance, on their regular Dragula show, they had Kevin Smith on as a judge. And they usually have David Dashmalian on as well. I think he's on this season as well coming up. Anyway, and of course, he is tied to comics. He's been writing comics consistently for 2 or 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for news. Moving on to our next segment, top books of the week, our top two favorite comics out this week. What was your second favorite book?
Mine was The Man Who Dreamed the Impossible, which is, I mean, it's by Mario Freitas and Lucas Pereira. It's basically taking kind of Jack Kirby's life. You know, obviously he's this iconic artist, comics god, and taking a kind of a fictional spin on it. And, you know, what if, in some ways, like, what if kind of Jack was almost his own hero in a few ways? And I think it's just a really great book about, I mean, not, obviously it's about Kirby and kind of his stature in comics and all that he's done and how he kind of continues to do through his influence and more people discovering his art. But I think it's also just about like what it's like to be an artist and, you know, the trials and tribulations and kind of what you get out of making art and putting it out in the world and what it is to kind of grow older as being an artist. I mean, there's just so much like stuff here. It feels like a really great kind of story about this sort of like old man superhero, like traversing the universe as much as it is just like a, you know, a tribute to kind of Kirby. And I think they balance it really well. And I remember kind of reading about it and thinking like, oh God, because if you know anything about
fictionalized story about a real person.
If you know anything about Kirby's kind of real life, like it was cool and exciting enough, like all the things that he did, but how do you make it more exciting? And I think, you know, they do a good job of making everything fantastical and weird and kind of amazing, but also sort of like keeping the core of what Kirby was, is this, you know, guy who's deeply dedicated to making art and, you know, kind of finding his vision and getting it out in the world and, you know, helping others kind of do some of the same. So it's just such a great tribute that also just feels like a really great story. And I would encourage everybody to go out and, you know, put in the time, even if you're a little kind of like precious about Kirby.
Right. Yeah. I was the same when I saw the announcement, because it was like, wait, you're fictionalizing a real life. But at the same time, Kirby has been in not only an influence, but put into comics.
Yeah.
That
he's definitely,
it's like he's already larger than life. Yeah. So why not go a step further? So it doesn't feel as, and it's definitely not, it's, you know, it's not condemning him or anything like that. It's
lifting him up. Yeah, absolutely. In every regard. I think it's just, they did a really good job of keeping what is important about Kirby, that kind of artistic hunger, that drive, but, you know, making it clear that, you know, this is like a markedly different story than his real life.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But also cosmic in its own way.
Yes. Very cosmic.
Speaking of cosmic, my second favorite book of the week was Death of the Silver Surfer #3 by Greg Pak and Sumit Kumar. I've dug this series from the very start, but this issue really opened things up, in part because there's lots of more action than in some of the previous chapters, because the Fantastic Four show up. Some background on the series. Basically, Silver Surfer is like the kindest, most endearing character who will save a mosquito or a human if he can, and he's nearby. And meanwhile, there's this like Elon Musk type billionaire who wants to steal energy from this giant Galactus-shaped casket. And in this issue, he has attained it and captured Silver Surfer. And it's not much of a spoiler because it's in the preview, but he stole a drop of Galactus's blood, which blew up a planet when it dripped onto it, which is so badass and crazy. Meanwhile, the Fantastic Four are investigating and trying to figure what's going on, which, of course, you know, it'll destroy the universe, as always. It's never a small thing when it comes to the FF or the cosmic. And there's a really good action scene with a new character that Pak has created here, Kelly Ko, who it's actually quite cool how she uses tech to fight each of the Fantastic Four and kind of holds her own, even though she's just a person with a super suit. The art is really good. I love the scale and cosmicness of it. And I'm starting to think this might be the best cosmic book of the year. I'm sorry, Imperial fans. I'm sorry I just said that.
It's kind of true. Imperial's great, but there was a comment somebody made either on the AIPT review or somewhere else that I saw in Blue Sky that, you know, Greg Pak does superhero comics really well and not like everybody else. And I think this issue shows kind of how he approaches the storytelling, the world building, but also, yeah, like you said, this is the first kind of action heavy issue. And I think Kelly Ko comes off really well kind of after that fight.
Yeah.
And she feels more established than she did kind of in the first
issue. Same thing.
Two issues.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's great. It's definitely top level cosmic storytelling for Marvel.
There's also a nod that we might see some familiar characters from Planet Hulk or, you know, which of course Pak is known for. Well, one of the many things he's known for.
Yes.
Which, what was that, like 25 years ago? I'm so old.
Yeah, God, it was 110 years.
I think World War Hulk was like yesterday. That was the last event, right?
It was 3 hours ago. It finished up. Yeah.
I wish I could live like in Slaughterhouse-5 where I could just jump around. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah. A non-linear experience.
Jump around. Jump. I'm just quoting one of Copeland's favorite songs. What is your favorite book of the week?
It is honestly one of my favorite. My favorite book of the week is The Voice Said Kill, number 2 from Cy Spurrier and Vanessa R. Del Rey. I don't know how else to like talk about this book other than I just think it's like my favorite crime story probably of the last like 5 years. I think it's not, it's a crime story that doesn't want to be a crime story, that knows that it's ultimately not a crime story. And I think it uses that framework and kind of that, you know, the feel of what you'd expect from a crime story to tell something that's a little more kind of dramatic and personal than I think you get in some crime stories. I think there's a tendency to like make them feel cool and kind of slick. And I think this one just sort of like uses that, like I said, that kind of framework of a crime has happened to sort of like talk about a region, talk about a person, talk about a person who specifically is, you know, kind of pregnant and is definitely a non-traditional hero in this kind of tradition of crime stories. And, you know, this issue, especially I remarked in my first review that you're kind of, you know, there's like a supernatural tension throughout and you're waiting for something to happen. And in this one, I it's a little more kind of grounded, a little more kind of approachable, and there isn't that kind of energy. And you just get a really great sort of, you know, back and forth between kind of, you know, people who seem good and people who seem bad. And even if you can't really tell if that'll kind of stay. And then there is a bit of a twist ending kind of at the end that injects a little absurdity. And so I think it, in that way, it kind of achieves its own promise while also just still being like a really, you know, to the earth story. And I love everything that kind of these two have done together, and they're doing something really amazing. And, you know, the art continues to be really gorgeous, and, you know, it makes me sweaty every time I read these issues, just because I think it's in the middle humid. Of a swamp. And yeah, it's super humid, but yeah, everything that they're doing is celebrating and subverting, I think, a great crime story. And I cannot speak highly of it enough. And I have no idea where it's going to go with 3 after this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know this was your favorite book of the week, for their first issue too, I believe.
Yeah.
And, Vanessa, I said this last time when we were talking about it, the art is just even better than ever for her.
Yeah, she's on a whole other level with
this one. And I love that show Ozark, and in a way it reminds me of that.
Yeah, when I interviewed her, she kind of talked about Ozark to an extent, and also kind of doing other swamp-based books.
Mm.
And this one especially, you know, I think just sees her kind of elevate that, and she just nails every part of kind of the bayou as this place, as this kind of like idea, as this tradition of storytelling. Like, it's just great.
Slap that on the back of the book. Nails every part of the bayou.
Boom.
You know, it's funny. My favorite book of the week was also a crime story.
Yes. Slightly different crime story.
But... a little different angle.
Yeah.
Because yours had bear people, right?
Well, yeah. It's too many bear people. That was one of my comments in the review, is too many bear people.
You know, less humanoid creatures, please. My favorite book of the week was Beneath the Trees Where Nobody Sees, Rite of Spring, number 2 by Patrick Horvath. What's fascinating to me for this new sequel series is that the first issue was almost completely devoted to this duck woman who's trying to find her dead brother, who we know, Sam, the main character, this bear character in the original series, killed early on in the first series. Yeah. The second issue, don't see this duck lady at all, and we only focus on Sam. And if you read the first and second issue back to back, it is like the perfect little starter. It's almost like I wish they put them both together, because they really go together. Because this issue not only catches us up on Sam, it introduces new characters in town. Sam now has to go even further out to do their kills, because they never kill, they never shit where they eat. And
eloquent as always.
This issue very early on sets up the fact that 56K internet has entered town. So it's sort of a period piece in that sense too, which is probably, I mean, it is for the better. I've talked about this on the show before, but like, if you put a cell phone into most stories or movies from like, you know, the 90s back, the problem can be solved instantly. And of course,
immediately. Yeah.
And it's interesting to see Sam at this end of this issue using the internet to her favor, or she thinks. But Horvath is just so good at creating all these characters, especially because you know they're going to die. Someone's going to die, probably a couple of them. And you're sitting there going, oh, this turtle is so dead.
But don't touch Birdie. Please don't touch Birdie the turtle.
And now the only negative I had in my review on the website, on AFPTComics.com, was like, there is like a couple pages where it's like, aha, you're setting that button up. Aha, you're setting up this detail. Which was a little like, okay, get it out of the way so we can get to the plot moving forward. But besides that, art is so unique. It's another one of these books where I'm like, does it need to be animals? And I think it does, because it adds like a cuteness, almost a innocence to American suburbia that we idolize in the past, you know, like the 50s or something. And all the characters are a little bit more endearing because they're opossums or turtles or birds. And there's also an interesting concept with wild animals entering the town, because big box stores are destroying all the land and taking away the forests. So there's an actual bear that has to be taken care of. Meanwhile, Sam is a bear, and no one goes, hey, you're a bear too. So I don't know. There's this interesting thing. There's like a layer to it that drawing these humanoid animals adds to the mystery and the narrative.
I really loved this issue, I think, for a lot of the same reasons that you did. I do think that, yeah, if you pair them together, 1 and 2, I do think it's just one really great kind of like opening chapter.
Right.
I think I really liked this issue more than the first, though, just because as much as I really liked the duck lady, I forget her name. I apologize to humanoid ducks everywhere. you know, I think that's a great kind of, it felt a little bit like a zigzag kind of maneuver. Like we were expecting kind of Sam, and we get this lady, and she's definitely going to be a sturdy character throughout here. But I think getting back to kind of Sam and the ideas of, you know, the world is getting bigger, but it's also getting smaller, which I think Patrick Horvath has mentioned in a couple interviews, is that's a big one, is that, you know, she's kind of losing control of the scope of her world, and things are moving around that she can't kind of dictate. I think that's, you know, that's when we're really kind of getting into some really great territory. I also think there's a really great shot, like after she dispatches somebody in this issue, where she may or may not be swimming in blood, like it's hard to tell. But the only thing I didn't like about this issue is there is that kind of theme with the bear. Yeah. And it's been a returning kind of device with the first arc. And it felt very like Twin Peaks, because they never kind of explain like, who is this bear? Why is it so significant? Yeah. And kind of what happens here makes me a little sad to kind of see that go. But I mean, everything else about this issue just works so well that, you know, they're raising the tension. They're kind of getting more involved with some of the big themes. They're letting more characters kind of tell their own stories. And we get a lot of stuff with with Birdie the Turtle.
The world's opening up a lot more, yeah.
Yeah. It's, so it's opening up, it's getting smaller, and it's moving in a really great way, and I'm excited. I love, I think this second arc might somehow be able to improve upon the first somehow. And the first is so great.
When I was writing my review, at first I was going to say, I don't get the bear. But then I was thinking about it, and I was like, you know, they very, the community is very like, oh, a bear. Like, it's not, it's just, it's something you can just easily kill or wipe off the map and no one.
Yeah,
care.
You move it, you shoot it, whatever. Yeah, it's gone.
And then I realized, oh, is this like a metaphor for Sam and how she sees everyone around her? That she can just kill them and it doesn't matter?
Yeah, there's a complete remorse. Impermanence to, yeah, it's it's just a bear.
What if this whole series ends with like a big twist and like they were all human the whole time and she looks in the mirror and she's just the person?
She's just a lady. Yeah, that would make me feel a little sad.
And then you turn the page and she's inside a snow globe. And then you turn the page and there's a sled and a fire. And then you turn the page and then they're all in purgatory. And then you turn the page and moving on to our next segment, Standout.
The Pal.
Moment of the week, our favorite panel or page. And I did not edit that. That went right in, I went right into the segment. This is where we talk about our favorite panel or page out this week. I picked one from Gehenna, Naked Aggression number 3 by Patrick Kinlan and Maurizio Rosenzweig. This issue really brought the book back for me. The second issue was a little like, what's going on? This one was almost all a fight scene between our main character and a vigilante superhero who wears a mask and a tie and some sort of like boxing gloves. But if you go to aptcomics.com and go to this podcast post, you can see the page I'm talking about. They're fighting in the scene. There's so much good fighting in this issue. And Patrick's mentioned in the afterword of the first issue, the series was very much inspired by a specific Punisher comic that he read growing up, where it seemed like it was not just an entertainment comic, but a how-to.
And yeah.
You get that from this issue especially, because like she does some blocks that I'm like, oh, that would actually work to block that punch. But that being said, this double-page splash is amazing because over to the top left of the double page, we have the Family Guy characters. We've got Stewie, the dad, the mom. I don't think the brother's there, but the dog's there too. There's also SpongeBob on the panel below that. And I just love it when you see The Simpsons, but like rendered in that artist style or rendered in a more realistic way. It just added a kooky hilariousness to it.
Yeah. I will say that this part of the fight, the whole fight is really great, but this part especially, it feels very like, just the way she jabs that glass in feels very like cold and distant, which, I mean, you probably have to do if you're going to jab a piece of glass into another human being. But I just, yeah, it's funny to like, you see SpongeBob and then you move over 2 inches and there's this like really heinous act being committed. And I love what they're doing. I love the sense of humor and how like serious, but also kind of stupid and silly it is. It's great.
For sure.
And this issue definitely got me back because I was also after 2, I was like, maybe I don't understand.
Yeah, because it opens it up with the main villain too by the end. Mm-hmm. But what was your favorite panel or page?
Mine was from Mortal Thor number 1 by Al Ewing and Pascal Ferry. Specifically kind of the what I believe is kind of basically the end of the issue or the most important. Yeah. And it's the whole concept of Mortal Thor Thor is basically human for any number of reasons. All the Norse mythology, everything you kind of know about his universe is either not real, is fictional, blah, blah, blah. So he's just kind of a normal guy doing a job. He doesn't know where he's from. He knows his name and he knows that he speaks Norwegian, I believe. And so he's just kind of like going about his life and he ends up getting kind of accosted and he dispatches a bunch of dudes with a hammer. And I think the thing I like about this is, I mean, I like Ferry's art just because it's very intense and it feels like you can feel the fury of the moment and like, oh, this guy's about to bring this hammer down right across this guy's face. But, you know, it's also very like there's some intricacy with like the background and kind of the lightning. And so that's a nice kind of balance of aesthetics. But I mostly kind of just love the idea that he's like you know, he talks, the bikers that he's dispatching, you know, kind of talk about their obsession with Thor and
right.
blah, 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 and how he's sort of this mythical character and trying to kind of, you know, pattern their lives after him because they think he's some kind of like great hero. And for him, you know, our Thor to basically be like, you know, that Thor is coming. Like, I think that it still shows like a level of kind of disconnect. Like, he doesn't right. believe that he's Thor, but
no,
he's willing to kind of capture some sentiment like, of that. So
you want to see Thor? Here he
is. Yeah, you want to see it? Yeah. But not that he like, and so I like that it like, because I was originally kind of afraid of like, oh, Hulk or Thor, but mortal. Like, that's, I feel like that's some version of kind of mm-hmm. that has been done before, like a depowering. But I think this does it in a way that it frames his relationship kind of in a new way, and that he doesn't fully kind of accept his Thorness, and just because he's like this violent guy with a hammer doesn't mean that he thinks that he's somehow special. And I think that really tells this story in a way that it should be, and I think it frames it in a, you know, a neat little package. And I'm excited to see, I hope there's more of that. It's not just like, well, I'm Thor because I dispatched these bikers or blah blah blah. I want more of that kind of struggle of him accepting his identity and fighting against it and trying to sort of be his own thing. And I want a real process. And I think this moment, I want it to kind of carry across the book.
I really like this issue. I reviewed it for the site, and it was the only reason it's not in my top two is it felt a little light. Like, it could have had a little yeah. more to it.
It's yeah, it is a little light,
but there's like the Loki character is fascinating. And,
yeah.
You know, I just love that he's brought back to a basic level that allows for new kind of stories for a hero that's been around for so long.
I like I said, I think the whole depowering thing has been done before, but this to me feels like the most interesting so far of kind of how far you know, Al Ewing is taking it from a storyline perspective. So I hope it carries through.
And I think you are more interesting so far for all the listeners, more than ever.
Wow.
After listening to this episode.
So nice.
But wait until they listen to you next week, which will be even crazier because, boy, do we have a surprise for you. Chris is going to reveal something, and I don't want to spoil it. Moving on to our next segment, top books for next week.
You painted me into a corner.
I was anticipated. You know what's funny is I always throw it at you and Alex. I'm like, oh, I make up this story or whatever.
Yeah.
And you guys never throw it at me. It's interesting. Anyway.
Because we're dumb.
Because you're kind. I'm dumb. You're kind.
Yeah.
And I'm evil. Oh, okay. What are you most looking forward to?
I'm most excited for Everything Dead and Dying. Speaking of blood and guts, from Tate Bromble and Jacob Phillips, I interviewed them a few weeks ago, and you can read that on AIPT Comics.
And next week they're on the show.
And they're on the show.
Our whole ever interview. What? Look at us. We're double teaming.
Double teaming the blood and guts. Talking to them, reading the first issue, like, I just love, like, I love zombie films. I love any kind of zombie story. I don't need it to be particularly inventive. Like, I think it's one of those kind of genres that just works really well. Like, even if it's oversaturated, but this one, I think they do something that is, it reminds me of kind of the early days of The Walking Dead, mm-hmm. where that in the best moments of it, it was a story about people that also happened to involve zombies. Like, zombies were the spice. And that this first issue is very much like that. It's, you know, a guy struggling in this world, trying to kind of keep his family together, keep his way of life going when he knows that it's kind of done and over with. And it's really personal. There's great, you know, kind of gore and kills in this first issue. It's everything that I kind of want in a zombie film, a zombie story, I should say. And it does it really kind of with subtlety and grace and intent. And it's not just about, you know, let's do a zombie story because they're kind of popular. I think they really considered the medium of combining, you know, zombie and a Western, and what should that look like, and how does that kind of play out? And I, you know, it just works really well. And, you know, I think maybe any other creative team, if they had kind of done, you know, Western zombie, it maybe wouldn't be as kind of personal, but they, you know, Jacob and Tate keep this kind of really intimate, and it's about sort of one man trying to kind of work through this chaos and this horror. And it's such a great great first issue.
It's very pandemic related. Like,
yeah,
we were absolutely all sequestered, and some of us didn't have a loved one to live with, or so we're just all alone. And what would you do if you were like that for
very long? Yeah, how do you make it through the worst thing that's ever happened to everybody?
My most anticipated book of the week is The Amazing Spider-Man number 11 by Joe Kelly and Pepe Larraz. I have three reasons. Pepe Larraz is back. Two, there is Spider-Man in it. Three, there is another Spider-Man in it. But why? So the last issue kind of teased up that there's two Spider-Men, and they know they're each of them aren't Peter and aren't Spider-Man. So I'm going to guess we're going to get some answers. Also, Cosmic Spider-Man. Looks like a big swing. Crazy stuff going on. Probably answers. Pepe Larraz. Need I say more?
I will agree with everything you said. I think this is a cool issue. And I had mentioned maybe a week or two ago, or 6 years ago, I don't know how time works anymore, that I was kind of getting a little lost with Amazing Spider-Man. But I think this is the one that brings me back, because it's just, here's a plate of everything cool, but also the story works really well. And it keeps its shape. It keeps its form, despite all the shiny bits.
Larraz. Pepe Larraz.
But just Larraz.
Dude, my review, it's going to say Pepe Larraz.
It's just a photo of him.
Yeah. It's like that famous Pitchfork review of the monkey.
Yeah, where it's just a monkey peeing
into its own mouth. Moving on to our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, our favorite cover art out next week, which Chris Copeland, I didn't mention this last week, is the leader of Judging by the Cover, the longest running column at AIPTComics.com. Man infuses it with so much care and kindness and insights. You should check out every Monday morning at 11 a.m. ET.
11 a.m. sharp.
Sharp. The tweet may be a little late, and I get yelled at every time.
Every single time.
It's weird. My phone just starts lighting up at 11:01.
Yep. 11:02. We are on top of.
And then all of a sudden, like, I'm getting hacked. My computer's like takes over itself. It's wild.
Your desktop. Well.
There's two covers
sorted out.
I really like this week. The one I'm going to pick officially is Lee Bermejo's Amazing Spider-Man number 11 cover, in part because it's the beginning of a new series of covers that leads all the way to issue 1000, which I'm hoping is a story in itself, because he did that with Batman. But I freaking love the way Bermejo draws a very realistic costume, where you can see like the ruffles of it. It's not like spandex, and it's not like the character was painted instead of just being painted, it's cloth. And also the web shooters are chunky and funny and fun looking. We also got this amazing montage behind him summing up his entire origin story. There's so much going on here. The lighting is realistic. It's like a photorealistic Spider-Man rendered in a way that would be realistic for our own real world. The other cover I wanted to just quickly talk about was Javier Rodriguez's TMNT number 11 cover. It is so freaking goofy and funny. This is the cutest Ninja Turtle I've ever seen, and they're just jumping almost to their deaths, it seems. It's funny, hilarious. I think a little kid would love this cover. The use of pink and yellows is just so striking. Another great cover. And also, I love the bulbous nature of their bodies.
I do like a chunky turtle. It is the winning design choice.
You know, it's funny. You also say that when you're in Paris, when you get your favorite dish, when they bring it to you, you say, I do love
a chunky turtle.
Uh-huh. All right. What's your favorite cover?
Mine is Star Trek Red Shirts number 2 by Chris Sheehan. I mean, aside from the fact that I just really love the idea of giving a platform to the Red Shirts, who have famously been like, you know, cannon fodder for Star Trek. I just think, you know, covers like this really kind of capture what they're trying to do in this story, which is it's senseless violence and stupidity, but it's also kind of a little silly and fun. And so I think that, you know, they're embracing some aspect of Star Trek that I think kind of goes maybe underutilized, undernoticed, which is, it is kind of a little hokey, a little weird. But it can also be incredibly dark. And I think if you balance those ideas, you get, I think, a really great story. And Red Shirts, and this cover especially, is doing that really well, of giving us, you know, kind of like this old school feeling story that's also, you know, got some body horror in it. And I just, this cover just, the first time I saw it, I just laughed for probably about 30 seconds, because it's just.
Uh-huh. Their flesh is just being ripped right off by some kind of laser beam.
And I assume maybe it's a laser beam that like they maybe turned on themselves accidentally, because like that would totally be on brand for like a red shirt. But yeah, everything about it just works.
Yeah, this series is a lot deeper than I was expecting. I thought it'd be like just senseless killing and fun deaths, but no, the characters are really well grounded by Christopher Cantwell.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're doing a great job.
Next up, an interview with Mike Del Mundo. But before we jump to that, big new column in AIPT. If you like TMNT Tuesday, if you like X-Men Monday, if you like Venom Unleashed, a new one is coming.
What?
We just keep amassing all the licenses. They're ours now. AIPT owns you.
Nom, nom. eating licenses. Om, nom, nom.
My God, dude, put those down. That's metal. Oh, my God. Are you Matter Leader, lad, in secret? I just uncovered your secret identity.
I am, but I only eat
License plates.
Creative licenses.
Oh, I thought you meant license plates. I'm so confused. Enjoy the interview. Bye. Come on. Mike Del Mundo, I have loved your work probably my whole life. I'm not that young, but I have to say, I can't wait for the Marvel art of Del Mundo. These art books from Clipper Press are stunning. It's really cool to see artists getting more attraction and attention. As someone who's reviewed over 5,000 comics, a lot of people in the game of reviewing don't give the artists enough credit. So I want to give you credit, sir, for spending some time with me to answer a few questions.
Oh, thanks, man. Thanks for having me. Same to you.
Your work is, I think it's above and beyond. It's another tier. It's like, you can't even compare it because of the, like, symbolism and the depth of ideas at work. I'm particularly right now just thinking of those Legion covers. I mean, it's concept-driven, highly stylized. How does it feel to see your Marvel career collected in such a high-end format like this, the Marvel art of?
Oh, it's all, like, it's probably be, like, a goal of mine since I was... Maybe it wasn't a goal. Maybe like this is something that like I never really thought would ever happen. Sure. But I guess when I did start working for Marvel, the thought did come to my mind, like, you know, that'd be awesome to see like eventually some sort of Marvel art book, you know. Mm-hmm. It took a while because Marvel wasn't flinching. But because Hank from Clover Press has been working with Three Worlds, Three Moons with us. It kind of came natural. We just kind of had conversations, and the conversation did come up jokingly sometimes where it's like, hey, we'll do an art book with you guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually I was like, yo, let's just hit up Hank and see if he's down. And yeah, he immediately was responding and was like really down with the whole idea. So yeah, now it's happening. It's real, you know. Before it was just kind of like a thought.
It's
like,
going to be in your hands soon.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing for sure.
And I mean, there's only been what, three at this point? I can't remember off the top of my head. I know Allred's got one.
Allred's, Russell, yep. Dauterman.
Yep.
Steven Mack. Like, yeah, I think there's like five.
Dauterman had this sick puzzle. Are you going to get a puzzle? Going to get a puzzle?
Yeah. Puzzle's happening.
Oh, baby. I highly recommend this. The Kickstarter that comes out of this just for the puzzle alone. Like, I love that.
You got the puzzle?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Nice. Puzzles are always nice. Like, it's always like, well, how else am I going to want this, like,
piece? It's a logical format for art, right?
And you make it, and then because you put time into it, like Lego pieces, mm-hmm. you want to keep it together and you want to frame it.
For sure.
It becomes part of you, so.
Looking back at your early breakout work, like, X-Men Legacy, those covers, how do you think your style or approach has evolved since then?
Man, it's just constantly evolving. It's even from X-Men Legacy, like the next project I did, it feels like there's gaps. Like, so if I'll do like a project with X-Men Legacy, and then like it's like a full few months of doing that,
mm-hmm.
and then I get bored, and I introduce myself to like new exploring like new art, like inspiration, whether if it's art or if it's dance or any sort of films I've been seeing,
sure,
that will like, you know, just be in my head. And it's usually a matter of getting bored and just being like, I need to find something new, a new brush style, like some new pen, some new digital tool, something like that to get myself like, you know, excited again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm constantly doing that. So like X-Men Legacy. And then after that, I think was like Elektra. And I was doing different stuff with Elektra. But for me, like, what directs the covers isn't the thought of like changing styles and evolving. It's more of like what best suits that story.
Sure.
Right, for each cover. So I kind of treat myself like, or act like as a creative director or like an art director. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm like, okay, this story's cool. What best approaches for this cover? You know, like, does it work best with graphic, kind of like a graphic quality, like a Saul Bass look or whatever? Right. Or like Norman Rockwell feel more painted? And I feel like I have both sides because I come from both worlds, like the art world and the design world. Mm-hmm. So
that shows.
And I get excited about that because I can switch back and forth. Right. And I never worry about remaining consistent. Like, I mean, I'll let the editors tell me that if they want. I mean, go like, okay, maybe we gotta like kind of weave these covers together some way or another. So I'll do that. But for the most part, I don't worry about that because it kind of gets in my head, and I try to be as creative as possible. It evolves based on the storyline, and since sometimes I'll find something new based on me working towards those storylines, and then I'll work with that style for the next few months, you know.
Yeah, I don't know why it's coming to mind, but Lee Bermejo's covers that ended up becoming a comic story, I don't know if you saw that, it was out of Batman. He did like covers, and he's going to do it again with Spider-Man, up to Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man number 1000. But like for a year, every Batman cover was a part of a story so that he could put them all out in one book and like it would be sequential in some sense. But they're all, of course, splash pages.
Cool. Yeah. I love Ibrahim Ibrahim's work.
Yeah. This new art book includes never before seen pieces in a companion sketchbook. Can you walk us through your process from sketch to final composition?
For the, like, how we came up with doing, like, a companion sketchbook?
Yeah, or, like, how those sketches end up becoming a final piece of art. I'm asking two different things.
Yeah, so, like, I'm not sure what to answer. Like, basically, the reason why we came up with a companion sketchbook is me wanting to fit everything into that art book and not being... Because we're like, we've only have 200 pages.
Got
like,
it.
We're limited to that. So it's actually a hard task of like picking covers and cross pieces and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
And, we asked the public or like the fans to see what they thought. But I always thought, I just want to put all these covers into like an amalgamation of it. And what if we were to like instead take, like have a book that coincided with the art book?
Oh, that's so cool.
A book that you can open up,
mm-hmm,
along with the art book, and you can kind of flip the pages and see the process or what was before, like the sketches before that.
Look at you. You're innovating on this, the art, Marvel art of style. You're adding to it just like you do with your covers.
Yeah. We're trying our best, you know, like that. I've always kind of like naturally just trying to figure things out when I'm get into the zone of whatever I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
I try to come with some ideas. But yeah, the main thing was me being like, well, especially like Jason Sorrenti, which handles a lot of, pretty much one of my good friends that handles most of my comic work and stuff. We always go back and forth on what we should do. And he's been a big difference in helping out with this book. And we've been like thinking about the idea of just putting out thumbnails. Because I've done so many thumbnails, like, especially with X-Men Legacy, when I was doing, like, each cover, because X-Men Legacy was one of those books that just, like, ideas would just come out of nowhere, and I was super, super, like, eager and excited, because that was, like, kind of, like, one of my, that was, like, an X-book, and I grew up with X-Men, right?
For sure, yeah.
But it was, like, I would do, like, 15 ideas per cover.
Damn.
And some of those ideas turned out to be some of the other covers.
Mm-hmm.
When I banked it. But yeah, there was just so many ideas within all those covers that I was like, it's such a waste that no one's going to see these things.
Mm-hmm.
And flipping through it now, I get more excited seeing those thumbnails than my actual finished covers.
Huh.
So, I was like, if I'm excited about seeing this and looking back at my stuff, then the readers must like be able to enjoy this as well.
Right.
So we tried to put it together, like, let's do a book that's like X-Men Legacy, let's do a book that's Elektra, and we're like, why don't we just take this, these ideas, and have it conjoined with the art book. That's so cool. it worked out organically, because you kind of like working with that idea.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really cool. It's always cool to see like how an artist works under the hood, right? And I love the idea of having two books open at the same time. You're like, oh shit, look at this, look at that.
Yeah, it's those ideas are everything to me. Like, I think more than the just like the anatomical detail or the draftsmanship of the whole cover. Because, I mean, when I first started at Marvel, I just didn't have that confidence to be like, oh, I'm the best artist. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But I was like, but I got good ideas because I come from that world. Mm-hmm. I thought like for me, every time I look back at my books, I could always like cringe at like some of the that I've seen just because I've gotten better as an artist.
Right.
But the idea never changes. It's always kind of like lasted and tested the time. Right. So, those were really important. And like I would hate for it to just go to waste. So it's
sure.
Collected a book. Yeah.
You're not just a cover artist either. You do interiors, of course. How does your mindset change or shift when moving from doing the cover art and the design and all that to sequential storytelling?
Covers are a lot easier. They're definitely a lot easier. Sequentials is just a beast. Like, it's just another beast. It's like basically doing, a cover is one panel of a book, basically. And then your thought process in a cover is basically just, drawing one single image without the thought of being consistent with that image. You just have to draw it. Like, you can, the way you want to draw Peter Parker is the way you draw Peter Parker.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to a storyline, you got to draw Peter Parker as consistent as possible with each panel.
Right.
So that's just one aspect of it. And then there's the storytelling aspect. There's like how you weave the panels together. It's like really a jigsaw puzzle. So I find it fun because it's a challenge,
mm-hmm.
but I also find it like really hard, you know?
Sure.
Whereas covers are at this point, I find to be, it doesn't cause that much anxiety, you know?
Well, it's fascinating because I bet there's a lot of artists that would say the opposite. Like, your covers are so iconic because of that one killer idea in a lot of them, right? Some artists are probably like, I don't know, Spider-Man punching Doc Ock, I guess?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing, though. Like, I'm not good at doing those kinds of covers.
Mm.
Like, there's just some artists that are just so good at creating one image of just say Superman in an iconic pose, and mm-hmm. it's just amazing. And when I try to do it, I find that like my confidence levels are not as great with that stuff, and it's more with so I always find it that like I'm compensating, you know what I mean, for like those insecurities. Yeah.
Something about your art that has always spoken to me is like this surrealist quality, at least in my opinion. Maybe you agree, but how do you balance surrealism with symbolism and storytelling? Because I feel like, unless, you know, you could feel like you're a crazy person after a certain few minutes thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm working on a cover right now, and it's like it has a lot of hands in it, and it's them trying to grasp, trying to reach for elements and stuff, and I was toying around with like, or just conflicted with, do I make this literal or do I go surreal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I'm just like, man, this is my language, you know, like let people figure it out themselves. They'll figure it out. The more, I mean, for me, I'm like, now I look at it as like, you know, like, what am I worried about? I should just be like working towards a feeling. So if it feels right, if it feels good, then just go for it. You know, it doesn't have to literally work. And the readers will appreciate it. I feel like readers will gravitate towards things that that you're honest about anyways. Mm-hmm. So.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you see so many like writers particularly say like the reader doesn't know what they want.
Yeah.
But so I'm just giving them what I want to do. Essentially that's what we're getting, right? We're getting a piece of you.
I'm always in conflict with that kind of idea, but I always kind of like conclude it to being like, comics has always been a language, and it's always been, you've always been at, like, artists have always been adding like their own language or adding to the language. Even since, you know, the Kirby's and the Mike Mignola's, like, that stuff is a language. Like, it wasn't before those guys, you know, there was no language towards what, how they created their art or the shapes they used.
Right.
I mean, but now it's a mainstay, so people use that language.
Mm-hmm.
So I always look at it as like, hey, when you do it, eventually it'll like kind of seep into the language of comics.
Nice. Yeah. I think that's a good tactic. Of all the covers and interiors featured in this book, is there one piece that holds particular personal meaning for you?
For sure, the X-Men Legacies, like we were just talking about, just because that propelled, for some reason, that book. Well, it was a funny story because I almost was not going to take the project because I was actually getting married at the time and had to fly to Hawaii.
Oh, wow. Like, congrats. Oh, wow. Congrats.
Yeah. And I was like, I can't do it. Like, there's just, I've got too much, you know, things to do.
I got to talk to Dave. It's just more on top of more.
I remember, like, Daniel, the Ketchum, the editor, was like, you got to do this book. He's like, no, you're going to do this book. And I'm like, okay. I still didn't really know what I was doing because, like, I was coming after Mark Brooks' cover run on X-Men Legacy.
Right.
And so I didn't know what they were trying to go for like, just stylization or, like, the theme of the book. But I think what happened was that first issue, when we started it, propelled everything after.
Nice.
So the first issue was basically like kind of a mishmash of, it was like a collage of different artists like Jim Lee. I think I put Frank Miller in there, or like Todd McFarlane, like a mishmash of all these artists, and to create like Legion's like face or body. Right.
Gotcha.
In a straight jacket. And it was so different that, like, I was like, and the Marvel loved it. So I was like, oh, you guys are good with this? All right, I can go crazier than this.
Nice.
So that propelled how that book was going to be. And, like, yeah, I had so much fun with that book. And it made, like, the editors believers in what I did. So after that, I was just getting covers and, like, they were just trusting it. They just left me alone. And then I did my thing.
Stake your claim on that one. What do you hope readers and fans take away from seeing your sketches alongside this final printed book?
Well, I just hope that they enjoy, like, I hope they enjoy it as much as I'm going to enjoy it, you know? And they're going to be surprised with, like, especially the companion book, because there's just so much stuff in there that could potentially have been covers, and I'll still bank it, and hopefully we could use it in the future. Just so much eye candy and just ideas like floating around that you could just flip through for days. So
are you worried some artist is gonna see this and steal your ideas?
No, it's like I'll just come up with some more ideas,
you know? You just make it look too easy, my friend.
Yeah. I find just that process is like the most funnest process for me in like doing covers. You know, I just take a walk with, you know, with my dog, and I just let my head just go.
Nice.
And I come back home, and then, but like the main thing for me is like, I never, like, I don't give up on a cover. So I'm like, I just, I'm just trying to find that idea, like that, the spark, you know, like the diamond in the rough.
Right.
That's why I come up with so many ideas. Cause like I could come up with like 30 ideas, but they could all be shitty.
Mm-hmm.
Keep going until I feel like, all right, this is the one, you know?
So when their artists are on the show, I love to ask them what's something that they hate drawing, or if they see it in a script, they might tell the writer, hey, can we change this location or not have them riding a horse? Is there anything like that for you?
Yeah, you mentioned horses. Horses are hard.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're tough, man. I drew horses when I was drawing Spawn. And I thought, hey, yeah, horse is easy. I love drawing animals. horses are different, man. Like they they have like their anatomy is just different. I just thought like, yeah, just they got that same anatomy as a dog.
I look at a photo of a horse. I'm like, how does that even work? There's so much up top and there's so little on the bottom.
Yeah, like I was like, oh, that's what their noses look like. Like, you know, my memory is like definitely not what a horse actually looks like. And they got like just bulbous like ankles, knees, and so horses, I would avoid that. Sure. But usually I love drawing animals. I that's my favorite thing to do is draw. Oh, try
animals. Nice.
Things I hate that I avoid drawing, I would say, like the total opposite, just like buildings.
Lots of detail.
You know, like Iron Man was tough just because, you know, he was anything that has that deals with like angles and like perspective and have to be proper, stuff like that.
Yeah, Ryan Stegman said baseball stadium interiors where there's like all the crowd and stuff. He doesn't want to do that. And then Dustin Nguyen was like, I can't do more than like two superheroes. If there's like six, I have to like think about all their costumes. Like, this sucks.
Yeah, I think that's like a common thing with most artists is like once you get over two or three superheroes, it just like it just becomes jarring because you're just like, ah, oh, fuck. Now I got a countdown, right? It's like, all right, I got like three. I got three more to go. You know what I mean?
Or like, how do I not show two of them right now in this one panel so I could save myself some time?
Yeah, like, can I just cover this guy up, like, behind that guy?
Right.
But then there's just, like, some crazy artist that you're just like, like, this is insane. Like,
Dan Mora is one that, he works with Mark Waid a lot, and I asked Mark Waid how fast he is, and he said two pages a day he can do, which I Dan don't Mora's understand. Like, what the hell does he have? Is he, like, does he have a twin in a closet or something?
He has two pages a day, and he's also... He does it like he worked on it for like
right.
a week. Or it looks like. He looks like he worked on it for like a very long time.
Right.
But he's fast and he just works really hard. And yeah, Dan Moore is like a beast.
He really is. It's uncanny. I don't know how he does it.
Yeah.
And just speaking about artists, before you were talking about, you know, getting an idea and walking your dog and stuff, I interviewed Wilsey Potasio about, this was a couple years ago when he was doing some covers, and he was telling me Marvel wouldn't let him see the script, so he had, like, no idea what to put on the cover besides, like, Juggernaut and, like, something else. So he just sort of wung it, but, like, he was visibly kind of annoyed because it was like, what am I supposed to do here? I only know, like, two characters that's supposed to be on this cover. I don't know what they're supposed to be doing. It's kind of interesting.
Oh, Wills is, like, my idol, man. Like, that's... He's great. It's funny how you mentioned him because, yeah, that's, like, you know, the big eureka moment of, like, reading his books when I was a kid, and dad being like, no, he's Filipino, right? He's got a Filipino last name. I'm like, shit. So that's a huge inspiration, man. And
for sure.
Like, we got to hang out.
Oh, cool.
But yeah, man, like, sometimes, like, that's a story. It's like, you just got to wing it. There's this time where, like, like, you just have to kind of be clever with it and figure things out and wing it. If they don't give you, any sort of information, it kind of just gives you the go-ahead to do whatever you want.
Sure. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. Sometimes too much information isn't good, and like just getting like one or two sentences really helps because you can kind of just take that and like expand on it on your own way, you know? So
for sure.
But that's what it is. Comics is just like deadline driven. Everything.
That's the other thing.
So you just got to wing it. And like,
I've talked to creators who are like, yeah, I was the fill-in, and like, I mean, what am I supposed to do? I have like 5 days. Like, what? And I'm just
sometimes.
Like, and then the freaking fans are like, this is crap. This is, and it's like, do you do know this is a human being that probably only had like a day to do this, right? Like, people don't realize that.
And covers are like 3 months in advance, right? Like, they get solicited 3 months in advance. So sometimes those covers might not have anything to do with the story.
Yep.
Because we're just trying to figure out, we're trying our best to figure out what happens in the story. Because
the story can shift.
Well, the story might not even be, like, having, like, it might not even be done yet. Like,
right, exactly. Yeah, I know. I was at Boston Comic Con a couple of years ago at a panel about cover art, and Joe Jusko, he was talking about how like there were so many cases where he drew this amazing cover, but then like the cover's kind of like the cliffhanger, which kind of ruins the story a little bit. But it's the cover they had, and they solicited it, so there you go. Like yep. It's tough.
It's tough. It's but you just work with it. Like there's times where like you know. When I was working on Deadpool Kills Deadpool, I'm not sure if there was really a storyline or they didn't know what characters are going in it yet. And I just started creating all sorts of different Deadpool characters within these covers. And they actually started, you know, taking these characters and putting them into the story. So it's a lot of times like, can be giving out ideas to the storyline, you know, or whatever characters that haven't been done yet.
Again, I got another name drop. Olivia Coipel, co-creator of Spider-Punk. I interviewed Dan Slott. He literally just drew Spider-Punk in like a background panel. And Slott was like, what's that? And now look, it's this huge character. And literally he was just like, here's another Spider-Man. I don't know. And now look how iconic he is, especially because of the movie.
Yeah, that's literally how comics is. And Olivier is like also one of those beast artists that's
insane. Amazing.
And yeah, that's how it works. Mm-hmm. That's the magic of comics, right? It's like
makes you love it even more in a way.
So fast, you don't have time to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But that also gives way to like style, new ideas. You don't spend so much time like just working on one piece that you know, like maybe I feel like a lot of my covers have been very time sensitive, and a lot of times I've come up with like new ways to create like a cover just because I don't have time to do it. So like new brush strokes, shortcuts, that, but those shortcuts become style and language. Interesting. So, yeah.
You've also been doing incredible work building it up Three Worlds, Three Moons with Jonathan Hickman. How does that creator-owned space challenge or expand your approach compared to this Marvel work?
Oh, it's like night and day. Like, especially with working with those guys. Those guys are like highly creative dudes. Like, Jonathan is super highly creative, and he's also an artist. So he's creative on both sides. And then Huddleston is, I feel like he's like my long lost brother, because like we kind of think alike in terms of like our approach and like how we like to experiment and find ways to create things. And he's just super highly creative, and working with those two guys and even Nick Spencer, it's just literally like we're on kind of like the same wavelength of what we want. We have the same kind of goal, and it's just to make really good stories, really creative stories, and nothing else. So there's no, and we kind of stay out of each other's way. It's like Jonathan will come up with an idea, and I'll take that idea and maybe try to make it a little bit better, or just work off of it and have fun. And then he'll take that idea and work off of that and maybe change it. So it's really like this kind of like evolving world.
You're sort of saying the same thing. I interviewed Dennis Camp a few months ago, and with Ultimates and the Ultimate Universe, he was like, Jonathan just stays out of my way, and that's why it's good. Well, that's not why it's good, but that's one reason why artists can kind of do what they want or need, and there isn't this editorial person hanging over you.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly what... Yeah, Jonathan just stays out of our way.
Because he knows he could trust you, too, right? Like, it's not... He wouldn't do that with anyone.
That's the hard part, too, is like... when we first started working on Three Worlds, I wasn't used to that. I was just like, Marvel is just like, you just, not that Marvel was, they stayed out of my way as well, right? For the most part. But you're just used to like when you're working on a script and you want to kind of go beyond the script a bit, I always bring it up to the writers just to make sure. Sure. Whereas like with Jonathan, he's just like, oh, I forgot what I wrote in the script, so it's fine. Just like, you know, do what you got to do, and I'll figure it out. Nice, and I'm like, nice. And then that happened many times until I figured it out, and I was just like, oh, this guy's just like really staying out of my way,
right?
And we're just gonna make this story the way that it is. We're
super freeing.
and he goes back and like he writes to it. So
cool.
Yeah, it's been fun, and no, it hasn't been. It's been a joy to work with those guys.
What advice would you give to artists trying to push boundaries or find their visual voice with superhero comics today?
Just don't give up on your idea, like on like what your original goal is. Because a lot of times when you start working for these companies, you start, I find that like people start to switch up and try to like, and I've seen this happen to myself, whereas you're trying to adapt to like whatever you're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to create that superhero vibe, whereas it's like they want you to take what you do and just put it into that world.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just trust your gut with everything, you know, and don't give up on. If you just have like, if you have like a certain feel or something that you want to do for yourself within that, just keep pushing and like fighting for it.
Nice.
Because that's what I did with like I always had that approach when I first started at Marvel, just because I came from design, and I always had that thought to be like, what I want to do in at Marvel with my covers is I want to just work in those ideas. That mm-hmm. was the main thing, and like hopefully eventually they you know they will they'll trust the process, and I'll just be, you know, not I guess not be known for it, but like I could continue doing what I do. I just never like I always fought for it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Don't give up. Yeah,
yeah. Even with X-Men Legacy, like it was always like they want me. They gave me examples to do with the initial first cover. They gave me examples of like what they wanted. He's like, can you copy this? Can you copy this?
Wow. That's interesting.
This cool poster that we saw online. I'm like, no, I'm gonna do. No, I don't want to do that. I kind of just was like, I gotta stick to like my morals, and I'm gonna do my own thing. And nice. Worked out for me. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, just stick to your guns. Nice. And yeah, work really hard and be a nice guy.
That's the thing, like people don't realize, like to get it to work, to be able to work in this industry, you have to like be able to work with people. You see some creators who seem really talented come and go, because then you find out, you know, they were hard to work with or were stubborn, yeah. or whatever.
Work really hard, but never like don't become a yes man. Like just work really mm-hmm. hard and like make sure you got your deadline. Make sure you hit your deadlines.
That's true.
But you don't want to repeat, like, you don't want to be the, like, to repeat not hitting those deadlines. And taking as much work that I get. That's just my path that I took. When I started working at Marvel, I was just like, well, this is, like, a huge deal. Like, I just felt really lucky to get into that position. And I still remember what it felt like just to be on the other side of the table. And I remember CB Cebulski's being like, we want you to do more work. Like maybe I did like two or three covers, and he's like, we want you to do more work. And I was like, all right, I'll do more work. So I've always taken all the opportunities that came around, at least for the first 10 years. Like wow. I was like, I'll just take whatever covers you guys have. Mm-hmm. And I'll figure it out. I'll do my best on it. And now I got like, you know, a huge body of work
yeah.
in a book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's, I would say hard work and not being an asshole and, and, you know, like, whatever dreams you have or beliefs or ideas that you want to put into these books. Yeah, man, just stick to it.
Nice. No, that's great advice. I feel the same way about not accepting more and more work. Like with AIPT, like, hey, can you do this interview? Hey, can you do this? Can you do this? Yes, 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 yes. And then all of a sudden, after a while, you have all this work, and then people like working with you, and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, yeah. That's, I guess that's the just the culture of comics, and I mean, eventually you're gonna burn out.
Keep in mind, you may burn out, but yeah. But just try not to.
Figure that. Try that first 10 years, and then you start being a dick.
You know, like I have a new era where everyone hates you. Yeah. One more fun question. If you could design a cover for any Marvel character doing something completely unexpected, like Hulk, say, being a ballerina, or Dr. Doom hosting a cooking show, what would it be? And how would you make it look cool?
Oh, man. Hulk is always fun to work on.
Yeah, I bet.
There's just so many cool things to do with Hulk, like messing around with a Rubik's Cube.
Oh, that's funny.
Stuff like that.
Giant hands.
It's like, yeah, like I guess I look at like the big guys, like the Giants, like Hulk or like the Thing. I always find them fun to draw. Yeah. Like my fan art is based on the Hulk, Thing, or like Galactus. So I would choose those guys. And what would the idea be? Yeah, I guess like Hulk, like working with a Rubik's Cube, smashing like a tiny laptop, you know?
Sure.
Trying to work the toilet.
That works. Maybe could you make that look cool though?
Yeah, why not?
Never give up. Mike, where can folks find you? Do you have a website to point people at, or social media?
Yeah, you can get me at Instagram at Deadly Mike. I think that's the same thing for I don't even know if it's called Twitter nor Twitter anymore, or if anyone
I call it Twitter.
Yeah. Facebook, you can find me.
Nice.
And my website, MikeDelMundo.com, if you want to grab some merch.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'm really excited for folks to check out the Marvel art of Mike Del Mundo. And man, thanks for taking the time. This has been a blast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I love Adventures in Portes, so it's great to finally be on.
And you love that name.
Yes, I do. I love that name.